Right, continuing in the papacy, its histories, dogmas, genius, and prospects. We finish up with the last two chapters of the second book, Dogmas. Chapter 19, The Worship of the Virgin Mary. There seems to be, on the part of fallen man, an inherent sense of his need of a man-god. The Patriarch of Uz gave expression to this feeling when he intimated his wish for a Days man who might lay his hand upon us both. Our intellectual facilities and our moral affections are unable to traverse the mighty void between ourselves and the infinite, and both unite in seeking a resting place midway in one, combining in himself both natures. The spirituality of God places him beyond our grasp and removes him, in a manner, from the sphere of our sympathy. We are dazzled by his majesty and glory. His holiness overawes us. His greatness, seen from afar and incomprehensible by us, seems to repel rather than invite confidence, and to chill the heart rather than expand it into love. Is there no resting place for our affections and sympathies, we instinctively ask, nearer than the august throne of the infinite? We need to have the divine attributes reduced to a scale, so to speak, which corresponds more nearly with our intellectual and moral range, and exhibited in one, with a capital O, one who, to the nature of God, adds that of man. This feeling has received numerous and varied manifestations, and the effort to meet it has formed a prominent feature in every one of the great systems of idolatry which have arisen in the earth. The nations of antiquity had their race of demigods, or deified men. In the modern idolatries, it has operated not less powerfully. The Muslims have their prophet, and the Roman Catholics have their Virgin. Here, says Popery, is a being who may be expected to be more indulgent to your failings than deity can be, who will be more easily moved to answer your prayers, and whom you may approach without any overwhelming awe. And thus, the false is substituted for the true mediator. It is in the religion of the Bible alone that this instinct of our nature has received its full gratification. The wish, breathed of old by the patriarch, and expressed with singular emphasis in all the idolatries that successively arose on the earth, is adequately met only in the mystery of godliness, God manifest in the flesh. But what we are here to speak of is the abuse of this principle in the idolatrous worship of the Virgin. Papists may make a shift to prove that it is a mitigated worship to which they offer to the saints, that they allow them no rank but that of mediators, and no function but that of intercession, though even this worship, both in its principles and in its forms, the Bible denominates idolatry. But the worship of the Virgin is capable of no such defense. It is direct, undisguised, rank idolatry. Roman Catholics give the same titles, perform the same acts, and ascribe the same powers to Mary as to Christ. And in doing so, they make her equal with God. To Mary are given names and titles which can be lawfully given to no one but God. She is styled Mother of God, Queen of Seraphim, of Saints and of Prophets, Advocate of Sinners, Refuge of Sinners, Gate of Heaven, Morning Star, Queen of Heaven. In Roman Catholic countries, she is commonly addressed as the Most Holy Mary. She is often styled the Most Faithful and the Most Merciful. In what other terms could Christ himself be addressed? The papist alleges that he still regards her as but a creature. Nevertheless, he addresses her in terms which imply that she possesses divine perfections, power, and glory. The whole Psalter of David has been transformed by Bonaventura to the invocation of Mary by erasing the name of Jehovah and substituting that of the Virgin. We give an example of the work. Quote, "In thee, O Lady, have I put my trust. Let me never be ashamed. In thy grace, uphold me." Here's another one. "Unto thee have I cried, O Mary, when my heart was in heaviness, and thou hast heard me from the top of the everlasting hills." And here's one more. "Come unto Mary, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and she shall refresh your souls." Blasphemy. Heresy. In the second place, the same worship is rendered to Mary as to Christ. Churches are built to her honor. Her shrines are crowded with devotees, enriched with their gifts, and adorned with their votive offerings. To her, prayers are offered as to a divine being, and blessings are asked as from one who has power to bestow them. Her votaries are taught to pray, "Spare us, good lady," and "From all evil, good lady, deliver us." 5 annual festivals celebrate her greatness and keep alive the devotion of her worshipers. In Roman Catholic countries, the dawn is ushered in with hymns to her honor. Her praises are again chanted at noon, and the day is closed with an Ave Maria sung to the Lady of Heaven. Her name is the first which the infant is taught to lisp, and the dying are directed to entrust their departing spirits into the hands of the Virgin. In health and in sickness, in business and in pleasure, at home or abroad, the Virgin is always first in the thoughts, the affections, and the devotions of the Roman Catholic. This soldier fights under her banner, and the bandit plunders under her protection. Her deliverances are commemorated by public monuments erected to her by cities and provinces. In 1832, the cholera desolated the country around Lyon, but did not enter the city. A pillar erected in the suburbs commemorates the event and ascribes to it the interposition of the Virgin. When the pontiffs would bless with special emphasis, it is in the name of Mary. And when they threaten most terribly, it is her vengeance which they denounce against their enemies. Excuse me. In short, the Roman Catholic is taught that none are so miserable, but she can succor them. None so criminal, but she will pardon them. And none so polluted, but she can cleanse them. There is scarcely an act which it is lawful to perform towards God which the Roman Catholic is not taught to perform towards the Virgin. One of the most solemn acts of worship a creature can perform is to give himself in covenant to God, to make over himself to Jehovah for time and for eternity. The papist is taught to make this solemn surrender of himself to the Virgin. Quote, entering into a solemn covenant with Holy Mary is to be forever her servant, client, and devotee under some special rule, society, or form of life, and thereby dedicating our persons, concerns, actions, and all the moments and events of our life to Jesus under the protection of his divine mother, choosing her to be our adoptive mother, patroness, and advocate, and entrusting her with what we are, have, do, or hope in life, death, or through eternity. Close quote. Some of the most sublime and devotional passages of the Bible are applied to the Virgin Mary. From the work quoted above, we may give the following illustrations, in which a strain of mingled prayer and praise suitable to be offered only to God is addressed to the Virgin. Quote, verse, open my lips, O Mother of Jesus, response, and my soul shall seek forth thy praise. Verse, Divine Lady, be intent to my aid. Response, graciously make haste to help me. Verse, glory be to Jesus and Mary. Response, as it was, is, and ever shall be. Close quote. To the Virgin Mary is likewise applied the eighth psalm. Thus, quote, Mary, Mother of Jesus, how wonderful is thy name, even unto the ends of the earth. Close quote. All magnificence be given to Mary, and let her be exalted above the stars and angels. Here's another one. Reign on high as queen of seraphims and saints, and be then crowned with honor and glory, etc. Glory be to Jesus and Mary, etc. Blasphemy. Now it is true, the theologians of the Church of Rome profess to distinguish between the worship offered to Mary and the worship offered to Christ. The saints are to be worshipped with dulia, the Virgin with hyperdulia, and God with latria. But this is a distinction which has never yet been clearly defined. In practice, it is utterly disregarded. It seems to have been invented solely to meet the Protestant charge of idolatry, and the mass of the common people are incapable of either understanding it or acting upon it. We not unfrequently find them praying in the very same words to God, to the Virgin, and to the saints. We may instance the well-known prayer to which in 1817 an indulgence of 300 days was annexed. It is as follows, quote, Jesus, Joseph, Mary, I give you my heart and soul. Jesus, Joseph, Mary, assist me in my last agony. Jesus, Joseph, Mary, I breathe my soul to you in peace. Close quote. According to the theory of lower and higher degrees of worship, three kinds of worship ought to have been here employed: latria for God, hyperdulia for Mary, and dulia for Joseph. But all three, without the least distinction or the smallest alteration in the words or in the form, are worshipped alike. In the third place, this same works are ascribed to Mary as to Christ. She hears prayer, intercedes with God for sinners, guides and defends and blesses them in life, succors them when dying, and receives their departing spirits into paradise. But passing over these things, the great work of redemption, the peculiar glory of the Savior, and the chief of God's ways is now, by Roman Catholics, plainly and without reserve, applied to Mary. the Father who devised, the Son who purchased, and the Spirit who applies the salvation of the sinner, must all give place to the Virgin. It was her coming which the prophets announced. It is her victory which the Church celebrates. Angels and the redeemed of heaven ascribe unto her the glory and honor of saving men. She rose from the dead on the third day. She ascended to heaven. She has been reunited to her Son. And she now shares with him power, glory, and dominion. The eternal gates of heaven rolled back. The King's mother entered and was conducted to the steps of his royal throne. Upon it sat her Son. A throne was set for the King's mother, and she sat upon his right hand. And upon her brow he placed the crown of universal dominion, and the countless multitude of the heavenly hosts saluted her as the Queen of heaven and earth. All this Romanists ascribe to a poor fallen creature whose bones have been moldering in the dust for 1800 years. Again, now this book was published in 1850, so 90 years. We impute nothing to the Church of Rome in this respect, which her living theologians do not teach. Instead of being ashamed of their Mariolatry, they glory in it and boast that their church is becoming every day more devoted to the service and adoration of the Virgin, by the way, which Martin Luther himself never disavowed. The argument by which the work of redemption is ascribed to Mary we find briefly stated by Father Ventura in a conversation with M. Roussel of Paris, then traveling in Italy. Quote, "The Bible tells us but a few words about her, that is, the Virgin Mary," said M. Roussel to the Padre, "and those few words are not of a character to exalt her." "Yes," replied Father Ventura, "but those few words express everything. Admire this allusion. Christ on the cross addressed his mother as woman. God in Eden declared that the woman should crush the serpent's head. The woman designated in Genesis must therefore be the woman pointed out by Jesus Christ, and it is she who is the church in which the family of man is to be saved." Here's the response. "But that is a mere agreement of words and not of things," responded the Protestant minister. "That is sufficient," said Father Ventura. "Not less decisive is the testimony of Mr. Seymour. As regards the sentiments of the leading priests in Rome and the predominating character of the worship of Italy." Now, the following instructive conversation passed one day between him and one of the Jesuits on the subject of the worship of the Virgin. "My clerical friend," says Mr. Seymour, "my clerical friend resumed the conversation and said that the worship of the Virgin Mary was a growing worship in Rome, that it was increasing in depth and intenseness of devotion, and that there were now many of their divines," and he spoke of himself as agreeing with him in sentiment, "many of their divines who were teaching that as a woman brought in death, so a woman was to bring in life, that as a woman brought in sin, so a woman was to bring in holiness, that as Eve brought in damnation, so Mary was to bring in salvation, and that the effect of this opinion was largely to increase the reverence and worship given to the Virgin Mary." Now, Mr. Seymour speaking. "To prevent any mistakes as to his views," says Mr. Seymour, "I asked whether I was to understand him as implying that as we regard Eve as the first sinner, so we are to regard Mary as the first Savior, the one as the author of sin, and the other as the author of the remedy." And this was the response. He replied that such was precisely the view he wished to express. And he added that it was taught by St. Alfonso di Liguori, and was a growing opinion. madness. But we can adduce still higher authority in proof of the charge that Rome now knows no other god than Mary and worships no other savior than the Virgin. In the encyclical letter of Pius IX, issued on the 2nd of February, 1849, soliciting the suffrages of the Roman Catholic Church, preparatory to the decree of the Pontiff on the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception, terms are applied to the Virgin Mary which plainly imply that she is possessed of divine fullness and perfection, and that she discharges the office of Redeemer to the Church. Quote, "The most illustrious prelates, the most venerable canonical chapters, and the religious congregations," says the Pope, "rival each other in soliciting that permission should be granted to add and pronounce aloud and publicly in the sacred liturgy and in the preface of the Mass to the Blessed Virgin Mary the word Immaculate, and to define it as a doctrine of the Catholic Church, that the conception of the Blessed Virgin Mary was entirely immaculate and absolutely exempt from all stain of original sin," close quote. The document then rises into a strain of commingled blasphemy and idolatry, in which the perfections of God and the work of Christ are ascribed to the Virgin, who is raised by the greatness of her merits above all the choirs of angels up to the throne of God, who has crushed under the foot of her virtues the head of the old serpent. The foundation of our confidence is in the Most Holy Virgin, since it is in her that God has placed the plenitude of all good, in such sort that if there be in us any hope, if there be any spiritual help, we know that it is from her that we receive it, because it is the will of him who hath willed that we should have all by the instrumentality of Mary. Look, we need no other evidence of Rome's idolatry. The document, it is true, is not a formal deed of the Church, but the difference is one of form only. For the Pontiff assures us that the sentiments it contains are not his own only, but those of the most illustrious prelates, a prelate is a cardinal, venerable canonical chapters and religious congregations. And of course, the sentiments are shared in by a vast majority of the members of the Church. The document fully installs Mary in the office of Savior and exalts her to the throne of God. For, in the first place, it expressly applies to her the prophecy in Eden, and ascribes to her the work then foretold, crushing the head of the serpent, and, in the second place, it applies to Mary the ascription of Paul to Christ. In him dwells all the fullness of the Godhead bodily, and in doing so, exalts her to the throne of mediatorial power and blessing. The pontifical decree on the subject of the Immaculate Conception may, after this, be spared. Already, Rome has consummated her idolatry, and its evidence is complete. That Church has installed Mary in the office of Redeemer and exalted her to the throne of deity. To raise Mary to an equality with God is virtually to place her above him, for God can have no rival. But Roman Catholic writers teach in express terms that she is superior. In invoking her, they hold it warrantable to ask her to lay her commands upon her son, which implies her superiority in power to him, to whom the Bible teaches all power in heaven and in earth has been committed. And second, they teach that she is superior in mercy, and that she hears prayer and pities and delivers the sinner when Christ will not. Now, this doctrine has not only been taught in words, but has been exhibited in symbol. And that, in so grotesque a way, that for the moment we forget its blasphemy. In the dream of Saint Bernard, which forms the subject of an altarpiece in a church at Milan, two ladders were seen reaching from earth to heaven. At the top of one of the ladders stood Christ, and at the top of the other stood Mary. Of those who attempted to enter heaven by the ladder of Christ, not one succeeded. They all fell back. Of those who ascended by the ladder of Mary, not one failed. The Virgin, prompt to succor, stretched out her hand, and thus aided, the aspirants ascended with ease. Talk about madness. Chapter 20, the final chapter in Book 2 of Dogmas. Faith not to be kept with heretics. There yet remains yet another matter, a matter not strictly theological, it is true, yet one that enters deeply into the morality of the Church of Rome, and which is of vital moment as regards society. Now remember this, I'm interjecting here. Remember what I'm reading you here, okay? Everyone that's in a position of power or government that is a Roman Catholic, you can expect that everything that I've just dished out to you in Dogmas, 19 chapters worth, concluding with the 20th chapter here, every last one of them holds to this. They hold to it. Those of you who are not Roman Catholics should be very, very concerned about it. I continue. The question we are now to discuss discloses to our sight a very gulf of wickedness. It is as the opening of pandemonium itself. One wonders that the earth has borne so long a society so atrociously wicked, or that the lightnings of heaven have so long forborne to consume it. This doctrine of enormous turpitude is the dispensing power. The Church of Rome has adopted as a leading principle of her policy that faith is not to be kept with heretics when its violation is necessary for the interests of the Church. This abominable doctrine, papists have disclaimed. This does not surprise us. A priori, it was to be expected that any society that was wicked enough to adopt such a principle would be base enough to deny it. Besides, to confess to this policy would be the sure way of defeating its end. Who would contract alliances with Rome if told beforehand that she would keep to them not a moment longer than it suited her own purposes? Who would entrust himself to her promise if he saw it to be the net in which he was to be caught and destroyed? Were living papists prepared publicly to avow this doctrine, they would be prepared also to abandon it, for it would manifestly be useless a moment longer to retain it. Besides, they are not prepared to brave the odium with which the avowal of a maxim so abhorrent and detestable would be sure to provoke. And this is the very mark of hell. Rome may wear this mark in her right hand, where its partial concealment is possible. But were that mark to be imprinted on her forehead, she dare not hold up her face before the world, knowing that the damning evidence of her guilt was visible to every eye. The living writers and priests of the Church of Rome are plainly inadmissible as witnesses here. We appeal the matter to her canons and her history, a tribunal to which she can take no exception. At this bar do we sist her. And here she stands condemned as the Cain of the human family, the world's outlaw. The proof, and nothing is more capable of easy and complete demonstration, is briefly as follows. The doctrine that no faith is to be kept with heretics, when to do so would militate against the interests of the Church, was promulgated by the Third Lateran Council, decreed by the Council of Constance, confirmed by the Council of Trent, and is sworn to by all priests at their ordination, when they declare on oath their belief of all the tenets taught in the sacred canons and the general councils. And it has been practiced by the Church of Rome, both in particular cases of great flagrancy and in the general course of her actings. The proof is as clear as the charge is grave, and the crime enormous. The Third Lateran Council, which was held at Rome in 1167 Anno Domini, under the pontificate of Alexander III, and which all papists admit to be infallible, decreed in its 16th canon that, quote, "Oaths made against the interest and benefit of the Church are not so much to be considered as oaths, but as perjuries," close quote. The Fourth, or Great Lateran Council, absolved from their oath of allegiance the subjects of heretical princes. The Council of Constance, which was held in 1414, expressly decreed that no faith was to be kept with heretics. That's non-Roman Catholic. The words of this decree, as preserved by Monsieur Elephant, L'Enfant, not Elephant, in his learned history of that famous council, are that, quote, "By no law, natural or divine, is it obligatory to keep faith with heretics to the prejudice of the Catholic faith," close quote. This fearful doctrine the council ratified in a manner not less fearful, in the blood of John Huss. It is well known that this reformer came to the council trusting in a safe conduct, which had been given him under the hand of the Emperor Sigismund. The document, in the amplest terms, guaranteed the safety of Huss in his journey to Constance, and in his stay there, and in his return home. Notwithstanding, he was seized, imprisoned, condemned, and burned alive at the instigation of the council by the very man who had so solemnly guaranteed his safety. When the Council of Trent assembled in the 16th century, it was exceedingly desirous of obtaining the presence of the Protestants at its deliberations. Accordingly, it issued numerous equivocal safe conducts, all of which the Protestants, mindful of the fate of Huss, rejected. At last, the council decreed that for this time, and in this instance, the safe conduct should not be violated, and that no authority, power, statute, or decree, and especially that of the Council of Constance and Siena, should be employed against them. In this enactment of the Council of Trent, canons, decrees, and laws to the prejudice of safe conduct to heretics are expressly recognized as already existing. These decrees are not revoked or abjured by the council. They are only suspended for the time. Pro hoc vice. This is a plain declaration that on all other occasions, Rome means to act upon them and will whenever she has the power. There has been no general council since, and as no decree of the Pope has repudiated the doctrine of these decrees and canons, they must be regarded as still in force. The instances are innumerable in which popes and Roman Catholic writers have asserted and recommended this odious doctrine. It was promulgated by Hildebrand in the 11th century. The cruel persecutions of the 11th and 12th centuries were based on this doctrine. Pope Martin V, in his letter to the Duke of Lithuania, says, "Be assured that thou sinnest mortally if thou keep faith with heretics." Gregory IX made the following law: "Be it known unto all who are under the jurisdiction of those who have openly fallen into heresy that they are free from the obligation of fidelity, dominion, and every kind of obedience to them, by whatever means or bond they are tied to them, and how securely soever they may be bound." On which Bishop Siamanka gives this comment: "Governors of forts and all kinds of vassals are, by this constitution, freed from the bond of the oath whereby they had promised fidelity to their lords and masters." You can add constituents to that as well. "Moreover, a Catholic wife is not obligated to perform the marriage contract with an heretical husband. If faith is not to be kept with tyrants, pirates, and other public robbers who kill the body, much less with obstinate heretics who kill the soul, aye, it is but a sad thing to break faith. But, as saith Marius Salomonius, faith promised against Christ, if kept, is truly perfidy." Justly, therefore, were some heretics burned by the most solemn judgment of the Council of Constance, although they had been promised security. And St. Thomas also is of opinion that a Catholic might deliver over an untractable heretic to the judges, notwithstanding he had pledged his faith to him, and even confirmed it by the solemnity of an oath. "Contracts," saith Bonacina, "made against the canon law are invalid, though confirmed by oath, and a man is not bound to stand to his promise, though he had sworn to it." Pope Innocent VIII, in his bull against the Waldenses in 1487, by his authority, apostolical, declares that all those who had been bound and obliged by contract or any other way whatsoever to grant or pay anything to them should not be under any manner of obligation to do so for the time to come. When Henry of Valois was elected to the throne of Poland in 1573, Cardinal Hosius labored ineffectually to prevent the newly elected monarch confirming by his oath the religious liberties of Poland. He next openly recommended to him to commit perjury, maintaining that an oath given to heretics may be broken, even without absolution. In the letter which he dispatched to the king, he desired him to reflect that the oath was not a bond of iniquity, and that there was no necessity for him to be absolved from his oath, because, according to every law, all that he had inconsiderately done was neither binding nor had any value. But Sulakowski, a learned Roman Catholic prelate, gave Henry more dangerous advice still. He counseled him to submit to the necessity and promise and swear everything demanded of him, in the hope that, as soon as he ascended the throne, he would find himself in a condition to crush, without violence, the heresy he had sworn to maintain. Thus have the councils, the popes, and the causists of the Roman Catholic Church enacted, defended, and promulgated this horrible doctrine. I'm going to take a moment and just explain. Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, in the year 2020, is a Roman Catholic. Look at the members of Congress, the judges in the states, the senators and assemblymen that are Roman Catholic that promise to do something and don't. They're easily doing it because the church gets them off. Think, people, think. Continuing. It is as undeniable as the sun at noonday that the church holds it as a tenet of her faith that it is unlawful to keep faith with heretics when the good of the church requires that it should be violated. The practice of the Church of Rome has been in strict accordance with her doctrine. Faith she has not kept with heretics whenever it could serve her purpose to break it. Compacts framed with the highest solemnities and sanctioned by the holiest oaths, she has violated without the least scruple or compunction when the interests of Protestantism were concerned. What, we ask, is her history but one long unvaried tale of lies, frauds, perfidies, broken vows, and violated oaths? Every party that has trusted her, she has in turn betrayed. It mattered not how awful the sanctions with which she was bound, or how numerous and sacred the pledges and guarantees of sincerity which she had given. These bonds were to Rome, but as the green withes on the arm of Samson. Her wickedness is without parallel in the annals of human treachery. Perfidies, which the most abandoned of pagan governments would have shuddered to commit, Rome has deliberately perpetrated and unblushingly justified. In the case of others, these enormities have been the exceptions and have formed a departure from the generally recognized principles of their action. But in the case of Rome, they have formed the rule and have sprung from principles deliberately adopted as the guiding maxims of her policy. We question whether an instance can be adduced of so much as one engagement that has been kept in matters involving the conflicting interests of Protestantism and popery when it could be advantageously broken. I'm going to interrupt again. Joe Biden, the alleged president-elect, is a Roman Catholic. And he and all those like him are just as capable of betrayal and then getting a free pass from the Church of Rome as if they had done nothing wrong. You people want to elect this guy? You're not fighting to stop this guy from taking the White House? Oh, brethren, wake up. I'm continuing. We do not know of any such. But time would fail, and space is lacking to narrate even a tithe, that's a tenth, even a tenth of the instances in which the most solemn engagements were most perfidiously violated. nay, made to be violated, framed to entrap the confiding victims, like the American people. The cases are innumerable, we say, in which Roman Catholics have made promises and oaths to individuals, to cities, to provinces, with the most public and solemn forms, and the moment they obtained the advantage these oaths were intended to secure, they delivered over to slaughter and devastation those very men to whom they had sworn in the great name of God. Politicians. Oh, could the soil of France disclose her slaughtered millions? Could the snows of the Alps and the vales of Piedmont give up the dead which they cover? These confessors could tell how Rome kept her oaths and covenants. Their voice has been silent for ages, but history pleads their cause. It has preserved the vows solemnly made, but perfidiously violated, and, pointing to the blood of the martyrs, it cries aloud to heaven for vengeance on the perfidy that shed it. In the Albigensian War, Louis of France, having besieged the town of Avignon for a long time and lost 23,000 men before it, was on the point of raising the siege when the following stratagem was successfully resorted to. The Roman legate swore before the city gates that if admission were granted, he would enter alone with the prelates, simply for the purpose of examining the faith of the citizens. The gates were opened. The legate entered. The army rushed in at his back. Hundreds of the houses were razed. Multitudes of the inhabitants were slaughtered. And of the rest, a great part were carried away as hostages. In the long and bloody war against the Waldenses in the 13th century, Rome never scrupled to employ treachery when the sword was unsuccessful. And it may be affirmed that the noble people were crushed rather by perfidy than by arms. They had much more to dread from the oaths than from the soldiers of Rome. Again and again did the House of Savoy pledge its faith to these confessors. But every new treaty was followed by new dishonor to the one party and new calamities to the other. The power of France itself would never have subdued these hardy mountaineers, but for the arts with which the arms of their powerful foe were seconded. Pacifications were framed with them, purposely, to throw them off their guard and pave the way for another crusade and another massacre. In this way did they perish from those vales which their piety had sanctified, and from those mountains which their struggles had made holy. They fell, unlamented and unavenged. The throne of the crafty Bourbon still stood, and the sway of the triple tyrant was still prolonged. But in the silent vales where these martyrs had lived, no trace of them now remained, except the ashes that blackened the site of their dwelling, and the bones that whited the rocks by which it was overhung. Their names were unhonored, and their deeds were unpraised by a world which knew not how to estimate the greatness of their virtues or the grandeur of their cause. But not in vain did they offer themselves upon the altar of their faith. In the stillness that reigned throughout Europe, a solitary voice from a distant island was heard saying, "Avenge, O Lord, thy slaughtered saints." The first utterance of a prayer in which a world shall yet join, and the first prophetic anticipation of a vengeance which, after the lapse of three centuries, God is now beginning to inflict upon upon the blood-stained dynasties and thrones which slew his saints. It was the same in all the countries of Europe. Wherever Protestants existed, they were assailed by arms and by treachery. And the latter weapon was 100 times more fatal than the former. The butcheries of Alava in the Low Countries were preceded by promises and treaties of peace and conciliation often solemnly ratified. Philip II pledged the honor of Spain to his subjects in Flanders, and the dungeons, the scaffolds, and the sanguinary troops by which that country was immediately thereafter inundated show how he redeemed the faith he had plighted. In the great struggle in Poland, in which for a while it seemed an even chance which of the two faiths should acquire the ascendancy, the Popish party kept their oaths only so long as they lacked opportunity of breaking them. When the struggle was at its height, Lippomani, the papal legate, arrived in Poland and unscrupulously advised the sovereign, Sigismund Augustus, who pled that the laws of the kingdom forbade violence, to employ treachery and bloodshed to extirpate heresy. To this policy is to be ascribed the ultimate triumph of the Jesuitical party in Poland. As the laws of the country, says Krasinski, as the laws of the countries did not allow any inhabitant of Poland to be persecuted on account of his religious opinions, they, Jesuits, left no means untried in order to evade those salutary laws, and the odious maxim that no faith should be kept with heretics was constantly advocated by them, as well as by other advocates of Romanism in our country. In the most of the southern German states, the Protestant cause was overthrown by the same arts. In truth, this maxim of Rome, that faith is not to be kept when to keep it would tend to the advantage of Protestantism or the detriment of popery, kept Germany in the flames of war with short intervals for upwards of a century. The advantages which the Protestants had secured by their arms and which they had compelled their enemies to ratify by solemn treaty were perfidiously denied and infringed. They were thus forced again and again to take up arms, and the successive wars in which Europe was involved and which occasioned so great an expenditure of blood and treasure grew out of Rome's maxim, which in almost all these particular cases was directly applied and enforced by pontifical authority, that such oaths and treaties were from the very beginning and forever shall be null and void, and that no one is bound to observe them, or any of them, even though they have been often ratified and confirmed by oath. I'm going to interject here one moment. If it hasn't come to your mind already, think about the First Amendment to the Constitution, which protects religion. Think about it. This nation was settled by Puritans, Protestants, but with the bringing in of the First Amendment, Roman Catholicism was allowed to not only plant itself once again in the presence of Protestants, it was allowed to grow. I continue. But the guiltiest land and throne in Europe in respect of violated oaths is France. In point of perfidy, the House of Bourbon has far exceeded the ordinary measure. We do not say of pagan governments, but of Roman Catholic governments. The kings of France were the eldest sons of the church, and bore most of the paternal likeness. Every one of their acts proclaimed them to be of their father, the Pope, who was a liar from the beginning. Did the poor Huguenots ever trust them but to be betrayed by them? Of the numerous engagements into which they entered with their Protestant subjects, was there one which they ever honestly fulfilled? What were these treaties, with their ample appendages of oaths and ratifications, but crafty devices for ensnaring, disarming, and then massacring the Protestants? The first edict, guaranteeing them the exercise of their religion, was granted in 1561. It was soon violated, and a worse persecution befell them. They were forced to take up arms for the first time to save their lives and vindicate their rights. They triumphed, and their success obtained for them a new pacification. And this was violated in like manner. Quote, "They," the court, "restrained," says Mezeray. "They restrained every day their liberty, which had been granted them by the edicts, until it was reduced almost to nothing. The people fell upon them in the places where they were weakest. In those where they could defend themselves, the governors made use of the authority of the king to oppress them. Their cities and forts were dismantled, and there was no justice for them in the parliaments or king's council. They were massacred with impunity. They were not reinstalled in their goods and charges. In fine, they had conspired their ruin with the Pope, the House of Austria, and the Duke of Alba," close quote. 6 times was the public faith of France plighted to the Protestants in solemn treaty, ratified and sanctioned by solemn oath. 6 times was the plighted faith of France openly dishonored and violated. And 6 times did civil war, the direct fruit of these broken vows, waste the treasure and blood of that nation. Notice that 3 sixes were dropped in that. The act of unparalleled crime, which brought to an end the fourth pacification, that of 1570, merits our particular notice. 2 years of profound dissimulation and hypocrisy paved the way for that awful tragedy. The greatest of the crimes of Rome, perhaps the most fearful moment or monument of human wickedness which the history of the world contains, the massacre of Saint Bartholomew. Look it up. Massacre of Saint Bartholomew. The chiefs of the Protestant party were invited to court, caressed and loaded with honors. The Protestants generally seemed to be taken into special favor and now shared the same privileges with the Catholics. So bright was the deceitful gleam that heralded the dismal storm. Not only were the fears of the Protestants laid at rest, but those of Rome were awakened, thinking that either the King of France meant not to keep his engagement in the matter, or that he was overacting his part. But the cruel issue did more than make amends. In a moment, the bolt fell. For 3 days and nights, the work of human slaughter went on, and France became a very shambles. At length, the dreadful business had an end. 70,000 corpses covered the soil of France. Paris shouted for joy, and the cannon of St. Angelo from beyond the Alps returned that shout. The Pope had some reason to rejoice. The blow struck at Paris decided the fortunes of Protestantism in Europe for 2 centuries. the Protestant faith was on the point of gaining the ascendancy, both in Poland and France. The sagacious and patriotic Coligny meditated the project of a grand alliance between these two countries, and of giving thereby a powerful center and a uniform action to the Protestant cause, and humbling the two main props of the papacy, Spain and Austria. As matters then stood, the project would have been completely successful. The other Protestant states of Europe would have joined the alliance, but, in truth, France and Poland combined could have easily made head against the popish powers and could have shaken the dominion of Rome. But the massacre of St. Bartholomew was fatal to this great scheme. The venerable Coligny, as is well known, Coligny is spelled C-O-L-I-G-N-Y, as is well known, was its first victim, and his project, big with the fortunes of Protestantism, perished with him. The Protestants were panic-struck in France and disheartened in other countries. The victory, which had long trembled in the balance between the Reformation and Rome, now inclined decidedly to the latter. And from that day, the Protestant influence declined in Europe, and it's still that way to this day, on November the 28th, 2020. The two centuries of dominion which have been added to Rome, she owes to her grand maxim that no dissimulation is too profound and no perfidy too gross to be employed against Protestants. The last great national act of treachery on the part of France was the revocation of the Edict of Nantes. Quote, "Never was an edict, law, or treaty more deliberately made, more solemnly ratified, more irrevocably established, more repeatedly confirmed, nor one whereof policy, duty, or gratitude could have more ensured the execution. Yet never was one more scandalously or absolutely violated." The Edict of Nantes, N-A-N-T-E-S. It was the result of 3 years' negotiation between the commissioners of the king and the deputies of the Protestants. Was the termination of 40 years of war and trouble. Was merited by the highest services, sealed by the highest authority, registered in all the parliaments and courts of Henry the Great, was declared in the preamble to be perpetual and irrevocable. It was confirmed by the Queen Mother in 1610 and repeatedly ratified by succeeding monarchs of France. Yet all the while, the purpose of overturning it was secretly entertained and steadily and craftily prosecuted. The rights it conferred and the privileges it guaranteed were gradually encroached upon. Think about the Constitution. Our Constitution in the U.S. gradually encroached upon. Oppressions, cruel and manifold, contrary to the spirit and to the letter of the edict, were practiced on the Protestants. And at last, in 1685, it was publicly revoked. When the old chancellor, Tellier, the Jesuit, signed the Edict of Revocation, full of joy at this consummation of the intrigues and labors of his party, he cried out, quote, "Lord, now lettest thou thy servant depart in peace, for mine eyes have seen thy salvation." Close quote. The proscriptions, the banishments, the massacres which followed, and which were second only to the St. Bartholomew horror, are well known to every reader of history. This act consummated the woes of French Protestantism and the guilt of the House of Bourbon. Tellier, in signing the revocation, had signed the death warrant of France. A chain of causes extending from 1685 to 1785, and which it requires but a slight study of the history of that gloomy period clearly to trace, links together the Huguenot proscriptions and massacres of one period with the revolutionary horrors of the other. Rome's favorite maxim, faithfully acted out by the bigoted court of France, introduced at the last reign of terror. How could it possibly be otherwise? Great part of the trade of the kingdom was in the hands of the Protestants, and when they were driven away, industry was paralyzed. The numerous and expansive wars waged against the Huguenots had exhausted the national exchequer, and new taxes had to be imposed, which pressed heavily on a crippled trade and a languishing agriculture. With religion had been extinguished the elements of morality and order. I'm going to read that part again. I want you to listen carefully. With religion had been extinguished, and this is the Roman Catholic religion, had been extinguished the elements of morality and order. A new and powerful element engendered by the Romish idolatry was next introduced. Infidelity, which passed, in numerous instances, into atheism, or what we would now call secular humanism. These terrible elements, which had their rise in the Huguenot persecutions, gathered apace, and at last, in little more than a century from the revocation of the Edict of Nantes, they burst over France in unexampled and desolating fury. All things were now changed, but so changed as to bear stamped upon them the awful mark of retributive vengeance. The Jesuit cabal was exchanged for the Democrats' club. Rome's sanctified dagger was set aside for the guillotine of the revolution. The Bourbon was gone, and Robespierre reigned in his stead. Bloodthirsty and revengeful, doubtless, but not more so than the tyrant he had succeeded, and certainly not so perfidious and hypocritical. Crowds of wretched fugitives were again seen on the frontier, but this time it was the priesthood and the noblesse of France. By and by, foreign war drew off into a new channel the energies of the revolution. But soon they returned to their former sphere, descended on France as eagles on the carcass or as the fires on the sacrifice. And now again they are seen praying, that's P-R-E-Y-I-N-G, praying with consuming fierceness upon that devoted country. Nor will they ever be quenched till the land of violated oaths and blood unrighteously shed has become the Gomorrah of the nations. Read thus, the history of France is an awful demonstration of God's moral government. Nations unborn will peruse her story and learn to avoid her crimes and her woes. Unfortunately, they didn't. The persecutor of the past will be the beacon of the future. But, it may be objected, these dreadful crimes and perjuries are to be attributed to the bad faith and despotic tendencies of governments, and not to the evil principles of the Church of Rome. Not so. It is Rome that must confront the appalling charge. She it was that broke all these vows and shed all this blood. She has associates in crime. Doubtless, But she must not roll over on them the guilt she taught them to perpetrate. All the dreadful proceedings we have so briefly surveyed, and they form a tenth of the woes which constitute the history of Europe. They sprang directly out of the detestable doctrine which the councils, pontiffs, and casuists of the Roman Church inculcated. In the abyss of her councils were these plots hatched. France and other Catholic powers did but follow the policy which the court of Rome chalked out for them. All their enterprises were undertaken with the Church's sanction, often at her earnest solicitation, and assuredly they were all undertaken in the Church's behalf. I'm going to pause for a minute. Think of every prime minister, king, well, not so much kings anymore, but every prime minister or leader of a country that all go to Rome. Every one of them. They all go to Rome and kiss the Pope's hand. Think about it. All their enterprises were undertaken with the Church's sanction, often at her earnest solicitation, and assuredly they were all undertaken in the Church's behalf for the extirpation of heresy and the aggrandizement of the priesthood. At her door, then, must be laid all this accumulated perfidy. The facts we have adduced undeniably prove that the doctrine that no faith is to be kept with heretics is regarded by the Church of Rome, not simply as a speculative theory, but as a maxim to which practical effect is to be given on all occasions, and to all the extent which the opportunities and the power of Rome will allow. The recent history of Europe has furnished a fearful commentary on the Pope's dispensing power. The sovereigns of Southern Europe have of late been acting on this maxim, and, as a consequence, filling their dungeons with the most virtuous of their subjects. Only this time, the doctrine has been put in force, not against the confessors of religion solely, but also against the liberals in politics. A catechism, in which it is avowedly taught that the head of the Church has authority to release consciences from the oaths when he judges there is a suitable cause for it, has been compiled by an ecclesiastic, is circulated by ecclesiastics, and taught to the youth in the schools of Naples. King Ferdinand, the bosom friend of Pio Nono, has taken the full benefit of this doctrine by revoking the constitution to which he solemnly swore in the awful name of Almighty God, and has told his terror-stricken kingdom that he had a right to do it, and that sovereignty is divine, that an oath infringing on sovereignty possesses no obligation, and that he alone is judge when the Constitution encroaches on his rights. The same doctrine of devils is taught by Liguori, who teach teaches that men may swear with any amount of equivocation or mental reservation, that, quote, any reasonable reason is enough, close quote, for violating an oath, and that an oath, contrary to the rights of superiors or the interests of the Church, is not to be kept with any party or on any occasion, and therefore, a fortiori, not to be kept with heretics. All this is taught by the infallible Liguori. What, then, are we to say of the strong disclaimers of this doctrine by some modern papists in behalf of their church? These disclaimers, it is manifest, possess not the smallest weight when we put in opposition to them the vast body of evidence by which the charge is supported. The decrees of councils, the bulls and rescripts of popes, the public and uniform actings of the church for well nigh 300 years, and the deliverances of modern writers in the Church of Rome, of Dens, Liguori, and others. That this was the doctrine of the church, no one can deny. That it was also her practice, so long as she possessed the power, is equally undeniable. If she has renounced it, let it be shown when and where. Renounced it, she has not, and cannot, without overthrowing the infallibility on which her whole system is founded. In truth, when popish divines abjure the doctrine that no faith is to be kept with heretics, they are guilty of practicing a wretched quibble. Their meaning is that so long as the oath exists, it must be kept. But the Pope, in virtue of his dispensing power, may declare on just grounds of which, quote, the necessity and utility of the church, close quote, is one, that the oath is null and does not exist, and consequently is not to be kept. They then triumphantly ask, how can an oath be said to be violated that does not exist? Were it their object to release the subjects of Great Britain from their oaths of allegiance, the procedure adopted would be as follows. The people would be taught that so long as the oath existed, it must be respected. But then nothing is easier than to put it out of existence. The Pope has only on some just ground to declare our Queen no longer sovereign, and the oath would no longer exist. We know not which is the more astonishing, the impiety of those who can juggle in this way, or the simplicity of those who can be deceived by such juggling. If those statesmen who are so desirous to form relations with Rome can find comfort in this very peculiar mode of keeping faith, they are abundantly welcome to it. But plain it is that when Romish priests disclaim on oath the lawfulness of the doctrine of not keeping faith with heretics, so plainly taught in those canons to which they have sworn, they are just exhibiting, as Dr. Cunningham strikingly remarks, quote, in its most aggravated form, the very enormity which they profess to abjure, close quote. This doctrine strikes at the foundation of society. If oaths do not bind, if vows and treaties possess force only so far as it accords with the will and interests of one of the parties, there is an end of society, and men must return to the condition of savages. And if saved from falling into this state, it can only be by one man getting the start of the others and making his will a law to the rest. For men must have some standard of faith, some ground of mutual action, and if they do not find it in the eternal equity of things, they may find it in the necessity of a universal and infallible despotism. This Rome attempted to establish, and in no other way could the ultimate disorganization of the world have been averted. But this does not hinder our perceiving the heinous sin and the ruinous tendency of her maxim. And it by no means surprises us that some of the great matters of ethical and moral science should have held that a community that contravenes the first and most essential conditions of society should be denied the first and most essential of social rights. Quote, if there were in that age, says Macaulay, two persons inclined by their judgment and by their temper to toleration, excuse me, these persons were Tillotson and Locke. Yet Tillotson, whose indulgence for various kinds of schematics and heretics brought on him the reproach of heterodoxy, told the House of Commons from the pulpit that it was their duty to make effectual provision against the propagation of a religion more mischievous than irreligion itself, of a religion which demanded from its followers services directly opposed to the first principles of morality. In his judgment, pagans who have never heard the name of Christ and who were guided only by the light of nature were more trustworthy members of civil society than men who had been formed in the schools of the popish casuists. Locke, in his celebrated treatise, in which he had labored to show that even the grossest form of idolatry ought not to be prohibited under penal sanctions, contended that the church which taught men not to keep faith with heretics had no claim to toleration. And that's the end of the second book.